look at chapter 6 of the book of Exodus tonight. Exodus chapter 6. Those of you who were here on Sunday night will remember we were in chapter 5. And in order to get the connection for chapter 6, because I did suggest that chapters 5 and 6 form a good introduction to the great controversy between God and Pharaoh in connection with the ownership of Israel. So in order to get our connecting link between chapter 5 and chapter 6, let us look again at the closing verses of chapter 5, verse 20. They met Moses and Aaron, who stood in the way as they came forth from Pharaoh. They said unto them, "The Lord look upon you and judge, because ye have made our savour to be abhorred in the eyes of Pharaoh, in the eyes of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to slay us." And Moses returned unto the Lord and said, "Lord, wherefore hast thou so evil entreated this people? Why is it that thou hast sent me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in thy name, he hath done evil to this people, neither hast thou delivered thy people at all." Now let us stop there for a moment or two and try to get a grasp of some of the truth hidden in these verses. I'll ask you a question, first of all, have you ever been disappointed in life? Should I put it the other way around? Is there anyone here who has never been disappointed? But let us take that a little further. You may get disappointments with regards to the ordinary everyday things of life. You may get disappointments in business. You may get disappointments at your work or with your family. But take it this length. Suppose now you are going to do a work for the Lord, and you are absolutely confident that the work you were going to do was the Lord's work, but it didn't turn out the way you wanted it to turn out, and you're disappointed. What would you do? That's the situation I suggest to you at the end of chapter 5. Now throw your mind back. 40 years before this, Moses had a determination to do a certain work. He was going to see to it that his people were delivered from their bondage. Now at that time, I don't suppose Moses had any idea whatsoever of getting the children of Israel out of Egypt. All he wanted to do was to make their position and condition a little better while they were in Egypt. But that wasn't God's mind. And God sends them away to the backside of the desert for 40 years. And then we have traveled through and we've seen how the time came. It was God's time now. And God says, "Moses, I'm going to send..." Oh, he said, "Don't send me. They'll not listen to me." And then God persuades them to go. And here when you come to chapter 5, he goes in before Pharaoh and makes the demand. And we looked at the demand of God. But right following that, there's the defiance of Pharaoh. Pharaoh says, "I'm not going to do it." Then that leads on to the device of Pharaoh, and the various things he tried. And it made the condition of things more severe for the Israelites. Instead of helping them, things got worse. And that's the point that brings Moses right here. His own people have come out to him. And they've said, "You're to blame for this. You just have minded your own business and let us alone. Why interfere with us and our condition here? You've made the matter worse. It was bad enough having to work in the brick kilns and make bricks, but now they won't even give us a straw. And we have to work longer hours. And they're harder on us now than they were before, and you're to blame. Well, Moses begins to think, well, if I'm to blame, it was God who told me to do this. Isn't it strange how he comes before God? And Moses returned unto the Lord and said, now that suggests to me that he had been before the Lord prior to this. But now he comes back to the Lord. And Moses returned unto the Lord and said, Lord, wherefore hast thou so evil entreated this people? You know, brothers and sisters, it's a dangerous thing when we start to blame God for doing things in a wrong way. God never makes mistakes. God never has made a mistake. If he made a mistake, he would cease to be God. What I learn here is that God is working all things after the counsel of his own will. But Moses had to learn that lesson. And in effect he's saying, Lord, you're to blame for this. Why hast thou so evil entreated this people? Why is it that thou hast sent me? Then he lays the whole thing before God. But now, when you come into chapter 6, look at chapter 6. Then the Lord said unto Moses, now shalt thou see what I will do to Pharaoh, for with a strong hand shall he let them go, and with a strong hand shall he drive them out of his land. And God spake unto Moses and said unto him, I am the Lord. And I appeared unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob by the name of God Almighty. But by my name Jehovah was I not known to them. And I have also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage, wherein they were strangers. And I have also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. Wherefore say unto the children of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will rid you out of their bondage, and I will redeem you with a stretched out arm and with great judgments. I will take you to me for a people, and I will be to you a God. And ye shall know that I am the Lord your God, which bringeth you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And I will bring you into the land concerning the which I did swear to give it to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And I will give it you for an inheritance. I am the Lord. Let us pause there for a moment or two. Isn't it strange how God is so gracious to each of us, so merciful? He could just have taken Moses and said, all right, Moses, if that's the way you feel about it, just stand aside. I'll get somebody else to do the work. He didn't do that. God understands us. He knows our frailties. God acts in mercy and in grace. If he had put his hand on Moses, and in spite of the mistake that Moses made here in seeking to blame God for what had happened, God still acts in grace and in mercy with Moses. And as I read that opening statement of chapter 6, then the Lord said unto Moses. Now you know, he didn't stop here and reprimand Moses for his attitude. In effect, he's just saying, now Moses, if you'll just listen, I'll tell you what's happening. See, God's working all things according to his own will. The Lord said unto Moses, now shalt thou see what I will do to Pharaoh. You see, Moses, as you remember again, in the first place, thought what he would do. And now when he goes in chapter 5, he goes in and he makes God's demand to Pharaoh. He seemed to have the idea that Pharaoh was just going to cringe under and say, all right, get them and get going. But it didn't happen that way. And it's not going to happen that way. Things will get worse and worse. And the plagues will come on them right until the final plague, when the death angel will come and take the firstborn, and then Pharaoh and his mighty host will be overthrown in the waters of the Red Sea. You see, God knows how he's doing it. At this time, Moses didn't know. His job was to simply go on and do what the Lord told him to do. But now, not only was their burdens to be eased, he said, you'll see what I will do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand shall he let them go. That's number one. And with a strong hand shall he drive them out of his land. The day will come when Pharaoh will not only be willing to let them go, in effect he'll say, get going, and he's going to chase them out. For as long as they remained in Egypt, as we'll see in chapters that follow, the longer they remained there, the judgments became worse and worse on the Egyptians until they could take no more. And the very people are crying out and saying to Pharaoh, let them go! If you don't let them go, we'll have nothing left. So not only will he let them go, he'll drive them out. Just the same as the whale got rid of Jonah, you know. And the strange thing that even the whale couldn't stand a backslider. He got rid of him. The Egyptians couldn't stand the children of Israel when God began to work. Not only would they let them go, he got them out. You've heard the story of the young girl who got saved. But she liked dancing. Dancing, oh, that was it. She never missed the dance. So she thought, what an opportunity now. Every time I go to dance and every boy I go up to dance with, I'll just witness to him. I'll witness to him. So she went up the first dance. And she said to him, are you Christian? He said, are you? She said, oh yes. And she started to give her testimony. He said, look, if that's what you are, you shouldn't be here. Get out. He knew better than her. You're a man that went to a soccer match on one occasion. You stand there enjoying the soccer match, up on the terracing, as they call it. And the fellow standing just almost in front of him was blaspheming and cussing and swearing. He had all sorts of things to say about the referee and all sorts of things to say about the people on the opposing team to his team, using some vile language. This Christian fellow couldn't take any more. He leaned right over and he took his fist and he wrapped him right between the shoulders. He said, shut up. What's wrong with you? He said, stop that language, he said. I'm not going to take any more of that. I'm a Christian. He said, I object to that language. The fellow gave him a mouthful. He said, if you're a Christian, you shouldn't be here. He says, get out. He was right. He shouldn't have been where such language was going to be used. You see, the Lord has strange ways in teaching us. And the children of Israel are going to get chased out. The day will come when they'll have to get out. For God was not only going to relieve them of their burdens, that's one thing. He's going to take them right out of the place where they were being persecuted. He's going to take them out to the place of separation, right in the wilderness, where they'll be able to serve him. But now Moses has got to be taught something here. And God is going to teach Moses that he's in covenant with his people. Notice how he mentions the covenant. Verse 2. And God spake unto Moses and said unto him, I am the Lord. You remember when he went in before Pharaoh and asked for the children of Israel to be let go. He says, who is the Lord that I should obey him? Right? God is reminding Moses, no matter what Pharaoh may say, I am the Lord. I'm the Lord who appeared unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob by the name of God Almighty. He is the God who entered into covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Verse 4 says, and I have also established my covenant with them. Now, if God enters into a covenant, you can rest assured he'll not break it. Men enter into covenants with one another. They'll sign their covenant today and they'll tear it up tomorrow. It's happened over and over again. There are certain countries in this world whose leaders I don't trust. In fact, there's very few I would trust. You remember, perhaps you're too young to remember, some of you, but others will. I forget that the years have been rolling on. But you know, when World War II was in progress, there was a man came over from Japan. And he was up in Washington. And he signed a covenant there. And I think while he was still in Washington, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Now, I remember seeing a cartoon in one of the British papers at that time. And it gave the picture of this little Japanese with a pen in one hand and his revolver at his back in his other hand. And he's signing the covenant. What did it mean? Nothing. Piece of hypocrisy. Signing a covenant for peace when they're already determined they're going to drop the bombs in Pearl Harbor. I can remember 1938, what has gone down in history as the Munich debacle. Four great leaders met there. Prime Minister of Great Britain, Mr. Chamberlain, the man that always had his umbrella. There was the President of France, and there was Mussolini and Hitler. The four of them signed a covenant. It was the sellout of Czechoslovakia, 1938. Mr. Chamberlain came home, holding up his umbrella in one hand and the scroll of paper in the other, and says, I've got it. Peace in our time. Peace in our time. And within a year, the covenant was broken and we were launched into that great World War II. Now, how can you trust people like that? Men sign covenants and they mean nothing to them. But when God makes a covenant, you and I can stand assured that God will keep the covenant. God has never broken a covenant yet. It wouldn't be God if he did. Now he said, look, I have also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage, wherein they were strangers. Now, if God's going to keep his covenant, how is he going to do it? He's telling Moses this. Now, he's saying this. Verse 5. I have also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. He is the covenant-keeping God. All the power of Pharaoh and all the power of Pharaoh's armies will never be able to prevent God from keeping the covenant and fulfilling what he has planned. Brothers and sisters, Pharaoh, with his power there, is only a picture, a faint picture, of world power dominated by the devil himself in opposition to God. The Lord said, even regarding his church, I will build my church, and the gates of hell, the powers of hell, shall not prevail against it. Sometimes you look around and you wonder if the powers of evil have prevailed, until you come back to the Word of God and say, no, we've got to look on to the final thing. And as you look on to the end, you'll realize that God will, in the end, triumph, and his enemies shall be overthrown. That's one of the reasons I like to read the book of Revelation over and over again. Because, you know, always when you come, it's like reading the last chapter of the story. And there you see God is all in all, and his enemies are overthrown. But now, having said that, notice how he uses the expression, I will. Moses has got to learn now it's what God will do. It's not Moses that's going to do it. He's only God's spokesman. Notice there from the middle of verse 6. I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. That's number one. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. Now again, I'll repeat what I said a little while ago. It would be one thing, it would be a great victory, just to be relieved of these burdens. But they could have been relieved of their burdens and still stayed in Egypt. But that was not God's mind. I wonder how many people today, even in our day and generation, would like to think that when they die, they're going to be able to get to God's heaven. If that's what it means to be saved, then I want to be saved. Because when I've got to leave this earth and die, I'd like to be sure I'm going to get to heaven. Right. But how do they want to live down here while they're on the way to heaven? They don't want to be saved from the sins of the present age. They only want to be saved from hell. Thou shalt call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins. When you talk about salvation, deliverance. Deliverance first from the burdens of Egypt. How about Luke, the second thing? And I will rid you out of their bondage. And I will redeem you with a stretched out arm and with great judgments. He's not going to only relieve them of their burdens. He's going to take them right out of the place of their bondage. Perhaps it's a difficult thing for us to learn. It takes a lot of years sometimes to learn this, the truth of the New Testament, that we're still in the world, but we're not of the world. In it, but not of it. I puzzled over that for a long time. Oh, I've had some strange things said about it. But you know, I'll never forget the first time I was going to sail out of the port at Liverpool. I'm going to sail over to New York. It was way back in 1953. And a storm broke out that day. It was very strange. And they couldn't get the boat out of the dock because of the storm. And we were kept in the customs sheds there for hours. Children crying and old women murmuring and grumbling and oh, I don't know. Nothing to eat. They couldn't get any sandwiches for us. We needed a meal. And we had a good friend there who knew the customs men very well. And he came down to see us. So he was allowed in, and he said, look, he said, They've just told me the ship's not going to be able to get here for a few hours yet. In fact, he said, it's not going to get down here at all. He said, they're going to take you folks from the custom sheds, and they're going to put you on board the ship, if they can manage it, up where it is in dock. That's what they did. We lay there all night and didn't get out to the next day. But he says, look, I'm going to see him. So he went to one of the customs men and he said, look, I have two friends here. He said, they haven't had anything since breakfast time. And he said, I want to take them out for a meal. He said, you allow me to take them out, we'll go up to a restaurant, have a meal, and we'll be back down again. He looked at him. He said, look, he says, it's more than my job's worth. He says, they've already passed through. And he said, everything's been stamped. Passports are stamped. Visas are stamped. He said, let me tell you something. This is the expression he used. He says, men, already you're deemed to be out of the country. Well, I was still in the country. Still in it. But I was deemed to be out of the country, stamped. And we couldn't even go out to get a meal in a restaurant. We had to wait until they were able to take us in a bus way up to where the boat was. We nearly got blown into the water that day trying to get into that boat for the storm. But I was deemed to be out of the country. And I said to the friend who was in, I said, George, that's a strange thing. So the Bible says we're in the world, we're not of it. Here we are still on British soil, British citizens, but we are deemed to be out of the country. I said, that's it. Look, he's delivered us from our bondage. He says he's going to take us right out of the place of bondage. I will redeem you. We're still in the world, but we are deemed to be out of it. The passport's been stamped. Why? Because you're redeemed. You're belonging to Him. You see, take the other picture. He's a slave. He's been working as a slave for so many years to a master. Along comes another slave owner, and he makes a little bargain. And he says to this owner, I'll buy that slave from you. Right? He pays the price for him, the price must be paid. But he takes that slave, but he's still a slave. It's true, he's been bought, but he's still a slave. But suppose the man paid the price and he takes the slave and he says, now look, sir, I've paid the price for you, but I'm not going to have you as a slave. There's the door. Go. You're free. You're out of it now. You're no longer a slave. How we've been redeemed. We often sing about it. I wonder if we grasp it. I will redeem you with a stretched out arm and with great judgment. And the price had to be paid. The price that was paid there, as we'll see when we come later on, the price to be paid for the redemption was blood. When I come to the New Testament, I've been redeemed, not with such corruptible things as silver and gold, but the precious blood of Christ, the Lamb without blemish, without spot. Not only will I redeem you, verse 7 says, and I will take you to me for a people. They became God's people. They were His peculiar treasure. He bought them. And I will be to you a God. Ye shall know that I am the Lord your God, which bringeth you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. See, it's all what God will do. I will, I will. And Moses had to learn this. It's what God does. I will bring you into the land concerning the which I did swear to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and so on. You see, again, let me remind you, if the Lord has bought us, we're not our own. We've been bought with a price, the same as they were bought. We've been bought. We're not our own. Again, we sing it. We died, we lived to God alone. I sometimes wonder if we take time to think those things through. And God is going to take us to a place prepared for us. A place has been promised us. The Lord said, I go to prepare a place for you, and if I go, I'll come again, receive you unto myself, that where I am, there you may be also. And I will give it you for an heritage. I am the Lord. Yes, brothers and sisters, we have a place. He's pledged it to us, and it's there for us. But now look, that being so, Moses has a charge now from God. Let's read it just for a moment or two. Verses 9 through 13. Moses spake so unto the children of Israel, but they hearkened not unto Moses for anguish of spirit and for cruel bondage. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Go in, speak unto Pharaoh, king of Egypt, that he let the children of Israel go out of his land. And Moses spake before the Lord, saying, Behold, the children of Israel have not hearkened unto me. How then shall Pharaoh hear me, who am of uncircumcised lips? And the Lord spake unto Moses and unto Aaron, and gave them a charge unto the children of Israel, and unto Pharaoh king of Egypt, to bring the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt. See, Moses, in spite of what God has said to him, I will, he's still making excuses. His own people were not going to listen to him. And then he says, Behold, if the children of Israel are not going to hearken to me, how then shall Pharaoh hear me, who am of uncircumcised lips? He's still making excuses, in spite of the fact that God has given him this charge. Now, don't let us be too hard on Moses. Isn't this exactly the way that we do? Isn't this exactly how men work? In spite of what God has done for us, in spite of all the truth we learn from the Scriptures, how often do we tremble and shake and we wonder exactly, have we done the right thing? Shall we try it again? Is it worthwhile? Well now, from verse 14 to the end of the chapter, and our time's gone, but from verse 14 to the end of the chapter, you learn something about how God chose Moses. Why didn't he choose someone else? If you were reading down this portion, you discovered now you have a whole list of names. These names might not mean very much to you. It's a kind of genealogy. You have the genealogy of the two great tribes. But then you come to the third one, and you're dealing with the tribe of Levi. Now, why was it that God didn't choose somebody from the tribe of Reuben? Reuben was the firstborn. Why didn't he choose someone from the tribe of Simeon? There's quite a lot of names there. But no, he chooses him and his brother Aaron, who came of the tribe of Levi. It teaches me this, I'll say this in closing. God can put his finger on who he likes. And it's not for you or me to question what God does. Neither should we question how he does it. God has the right to do whatever he desires. Why men and women will not accept that truth today, I can't understand. As I read through the Bible, I discover it's God's book, it's a revelation of God. And whatever God does is right. And I have no right to question God's workings. He put his hand on Moses. He chose Moses. And he used Moses for 40 years. To lead the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt and to lead them through the wilderness. And you all know, of course, that the law came by Moses. He was the lawgiver, a great man, a of God. Perhaps our brother Stiles will close with a word of prayer.